Y'all, welcome back to another episode on the Promethean Perspective. Woo, I was going back to my southern roots in that intro there. I was all like, y'all, let's go, people. Let's all get up on this bandwagon. We'll go out oh yonder and we'll listen to oh yonder. let's just move along. Back to the Promethean Perspective. I am your host, Emily Ryback, and I'm so excited that you are joining me for yet again another episode. Alright, so if you guys were here for the last episode, you know that we did a very practical one. We talked all about mornings and how to become a morning person. And I thought, from the feedback that I got from y'all, that the best way to balance the content that I'm putting out would be 1 week do kind of more of a practical, lifestyle kind of Promethean Perspective episode. And then the next week, really go into some theological, kind of religious, spirituality, philosophical topics that the other spectrum of the population would like to hear. So we're going to switch back and forth between those every week. So just stay tuned and you guys can know like which ones would be more suiting to your personality, what you like to listen to, and like when you like to listen to that kind of stuff. Because like, you know, preference is good, I think. I don't know. Sometimes it can get a little messy. Preferences can be a little dramatic. It's going to be a great episode. Today we're going to be talking all about freedom, desires, intention. We're basically going to be doing like a little bit theology 101 about morality. It's going to be a good ride. It'll be a little bit basic, like if you're already in that realm of theology and you kind of already have a grasp for theology. But if you don't, this is like just the perfect episode for you because it's like that basic kind of back to the beginning. Just kind of my perspective and opinion on morality. Freedom, desires, and intentions. This is something that's actually very close to my heart, especially growing up in the world that we do. I think it's very, very important that people my age have a firm, solid foundation of what they believe, why, etc., etc. Before we go into any of that, let's get to our glory story for the week. Alright, so my glory story for the week, guys. It's not anything like amazing or fantastic, but it's bringing me a lot of comfort, and it's something that I've just really been enjoying lately, and that is just my family. Okay, that probably sounds really ridiculously cheesy. I don't really care if you think it sounds that way because I don't care. But my family has been just amazing. I've loved hanging out with them lately. We've been doing some really, really fun things like shooting bow and arrows and doing slingshots and just, we did a caber toss today and it was just, y'all, my family's just the greatest and I've just been having the most fun with them and I'm thankful for them. They're my glory story for this week. So, if y'all are listening to this, keep on being awesome, fam. I love y'all. All right, let's. Let's hop into today's episode and get on to morality. Alright, so we're just literally going to jump right into this topic. No banter, no side tangents or introductions. Charles is not here with me this week, so I don't really have any excuses to get distracted. I was listening to the content from last week, and there was a lot of side tangents. I probably should have edited a lot out. A lot of you were probably really annoyed with the side tangents, but a lot of you said that you enjoyed it because you kind of got a little bit of insight on our relationship. So that's kind of fun to share with you guys. But we're going to literally hop right into this episode because my family and I we're having like a family dinner tonight. So I need to hurry up and get this out there for y'all so I can go spend some time with them. So I want to start with a Bible verse from Titus, chapter 2, verses 11 to 13. So if you got your Bible, pull it out and read along with me. Maybe take some notes, jot down something that came to mind while you're reading it. It says, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all, training us to renounce impiety and worldly passions, and in the present age to live lives that are self-controlled, upright and godly, while we wait for the blessed hope and manifestation of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." The reason why I wanted to talk about this topic is because we often hear about like our nature and how we are born with natural desires that we should follow and how we cannot be like, no one should judge us for those actions that we engage in, you know, as a result. And, you know, while this is true that we have natural inclinations and that are like our desires and the things we desire and crave and what we have an appetite for, it's all part of our human nature. Like, we're more than mere animals with desires and instincts that we must blindly follow. And I think that's pretty obvious to all of us. You're like, Emily, where are you going with all this? Okay, I'm getting to the point. You know, human beings are rational creatures, which means that we possess an intellect with the ability to reason, and that is intrinsic to our nature. You know, with our reasoning capacity, like, we can determine what is compatible or incompatible with our goal of true and lasting happiness. All right, just a side note, when it comes to words like incompatible, I always hesitate. It's like, wait, is it IN or EN or is it uncompatible? I always get so confused with those prefixes. Anyways, when we use our reasoning capacity and we determine what is feasible or unfeasible with our goal of true and lasting happiness, what is right and what is wrong, you know, truly good actions are virtuous actions that revolve and involve all the powers of man's intellect, reason, powers, desires, will. These virtuous actions essentially align with what we know is good, and that makes us better and happier people. So that's kind of like the purpose of this episode. We're talking about how all of this culminates into a virtuous life and in the end makes us a happier person. I want to share my perspective with you guys on this topic because I think that it's something that's really lacking in our society, is that people either don't speak about their perspective or it's kind of like an unstable foundation for their perspective and it's kind of faltering. And so I kind of wanted to share with you guys my perspective. So if you are a young listener around my age or something, hopefully this is really helpful for you guys, especially if you're trying to find your own footing in the world and everything society is telling you. Because many in today's society seek some form of freedom, like as the ultimate good in itself. I mean, we know this. Consequently, you know, holding up the pursuit of freedom has the supreme goal of life. And we often want to avoid like any authority that opposes this kind of subjective desire or any kind of authority which might place perceived limits on human freedom. You know, there's a legitimate authority that is often avoided or rejected, even if it is, you know, proven to be a guiding force for the true good. And even if the precepts that it supplies are for both the immediate and ultimate good of the individual. So I think for many in today's culture, freedom is like thought to mean an autonomous, like, independence of the will, allowing it to select between different moral choices that are presented. And contrary to this thought, this notion, you know, human freedom is not simply the power to act, but to do so rooted in both the reason and the will. And it is the power to act for the good in accordance with reason, the will, and desire. It is where the power lies, because, you know, St. Thomas said that freedom basically finds its greatest expression when it's used as a tool to bring us closer to God, because freedom is not simply the ability to, like, choose one thing over another arbitrarily, like disregarding every other feature or criteria. You know, that would be way too limiting to the understanding of freedom, and it would introduce far too late in the decision-making process. I kind of wanted to let you guys know about this awesome quote in the Catechism. If you're not Catholic, the Catechism is basically like, the encyclopedia for the Catholic faith. It's phenomenal. It's like uses scripture and like the doctrines of the church and like the teachings of the magisterium. It just like culminates all into this like super punch. It's just like phenomenal. It's an amazing read. So the Catechism of the Catholic Church says in paragraph 1731, freedom is the power rooted in reason and will to act or not to act, to do this or that, and to perform deliberate actions on one's own responsibility. By free will, one shapes one's life, and human freedom is a force for growth, maturity in truth and goodness. It attains its perfection when directed towards God, our beatitude. Unquote. So freedom is not simply the ability to choose between all of the possible actions available to an individual, but freedom is the power to use all of our capacities and abilities to make the right decisions. So let's kind of examine the features of action and decision making, and then we'll kind of return to the concept of freedom just to kind of put the puzzle pieces together. I want to talk about desire for a second. Our desire making process begins with a desire for something. It's kind of a very straightforward concept, because every living being in creation has a desire, attraction, repulsion from other objects in creation. And as humans, these attractions in general, they're pretty universal in that we all have natural desires, such as a desire for life, a desire for companionship, a desire to know truth, you know, because each individual, and even for different groups of people, such as different cultures, specific desires for particular things may take different forms. Like, for example, in a desire to live and continue my life, you must also desire, like, food and sustenance for your body. Because there are many foods capable of sustaining you, and many will be pleasurable. And when you got to eat with your friends, you know, you have that shared desire for both companionship and the sustenance of food that, in the end, is pleasing to your palates. So when you order from the menu, you know, though it is likely that you will all choose something different, you know, like one may order pasta or steak or pizza in a different culture, which today might be even next door, a person might have formed a desire for foods of a different type, such as spicy or bland, you know. So in this desire, the desires provides us with the first step in making distinct choices as human beings that incline us to live a very natural order, have a desire for life in a very natural way. Because it provides the attraction to a particular object and essentially informs our other abilities and powers. So, you know, I think desire is kind of one of those words that gets tossed around in society and, like, kind of torn apart and then put back together. And it's, like, got this really off meaning, and it's not, like, the actual definition of the word. And then people can just change it depending on the mood they wake up in that day. So I think, for me, something very important in finding my perspective on this kind of topic concerning morality was finding a authentic definition of desire. And so, in my opinion, desire essentially is the attraction or repulsion from any object as perceived by an individual. And as human beings, like, we are rational creatures of both body and soul. We possess intellect and will, and we are capable of freely choosing this or that, good or evil, etc., etc. Consequently, though, you know, we are moral agents when we choose to act freely, and so our acts have a moral quality, you know, and the morality of human acts depends upon three essential sources, which I want to touch on, the first being the object chosen, the second being the end view of our intention, and thirdly, the circumstances of the action. Now, all of these are listed in the Catechism if you care to expound upon them any further. Basically, just informs you, like, what has to be in place for morality and for things to be a moral sin, and basically just the realm of what we're talking about right now. It's all in much greater detail in the Catechism, basically in paragraph 1750. So let's look at these three sources for a moment. The first being the object, the intention, the circumstances. All right, so let's look at these. All right, so the first being intention. We know that in order to perform an act as a human, you know, we must not only desire something, but we must also have an intention to act. Intention is the goal that directs an action. All right, so, like, remember that. The, like, intention is the goal that directs an action and makes it meaningful. It's not simply a desire for a thing or, like, a sense of an obligation, of a need. Like, it includes a desire in that we are drawn toward or repulsed toward something. Intention is more than that, however. Including, like, an amount of reasoned understanding of the thing that, like, we desire and have a will toward. You know, when we intend to do something, we not only desire a particular thing, but we actually, like, form a desire into a specific plan of action, and then we move towards that. And that object of desire becomes a goal towards which we are moving, which we are traveling towards. So intention is that sought after goal that directs an action and makes it meaningful. And everyone is likely to have more than one intention. In our previous example, where I was talking about food and sustain and how it sustains your life, you know, you might intend to eat something that helps sustain your body, to enjoy a new type of food, as well to enjoy the companies of your friends or family. You know, and under a morality of happiness approach, one of the intentions of our action is always the attainment of our ultimate happiness. And so we desire ultimate happiness, aka beatitude, and ideally each of our actions take us closer to this goal. You know, while our ultimate happiness is a long-term goal, short-term goals bring us along the path to happiness as well. And in this case, you know, a short-term goal of enjoying food and sharing company with your friend aligns with and promotes your goal of happiness. That doesn't mean our short-term goal, you know, is, like, merely an instrumental step towards our ultimate goal. It means, like, the short-term goal cannot and does not conflict with our long-term goal and might help us in the process. So this also does not mean that people who choose, like, other systems of morality, such as morality of obligation, do not perform actions with both short and long-term intentions. So it's a fact that all human acts have an intention unless, like, one is forced to do something against his will, which case one person forces his intention on another, for an example. Otherwise, they would, you know, not be human acts of rational nature. So intention is then, you know, like, one of the requirements for a truly human act. And it's an integral part of human action because it's a crucial part that gives meaning to each action. Intention is that assistance in determining the moral quality of an action. For example, if you were to give money to the poor to improve their situation, which is a good intention, or you might give it in order to look good in front of your friends, which is a bad intention. As you can see, each of these intentions has a significantly different moral quality. And so furthermore, in giving this money, you might have all these and more intentions in mind. And so although your intentions may be multifaceted, you know, one particular element of its primary, of it is primary to my act. In other words, even though you might have more than one intention involved in the act of giving money to the poor, there is a first goal intention which indicates the purpose pursued in the action. So knowing your reasons for acting, basically evaluating your intentions, really helps determine both whether your action is morally good or not and whether you've actually achieved the goal that you were going after, right? So there's this whole paragraph in the Catechism. Sorry to reference it so much, like, sorry, not sorry. I can't help it. But paragraph 1752 says, "The intention resides in the acting subject because it lies at the voluntary source of an action and determines it by its end. Intention is an element essential to the moral evaluation of an action. The end is the first goal of the intention and indicates the purpose pursued in the action. The intention is a movement of the will toward the end. It is concerned with the goal of activity. For example, a service done with the end of helping one's neighbor can at the same time be inspired by the love of God as the ultimate end of our actions. One and the same action can also be inspired by several intentions, such as performing a service in order to obtain a favor or boast about it." Okay, so if an act is entirely devoid of any intention, it has absolutely no subjective moral significance for the person acting, all right? This means that basically the actions that are forced, not merely done under duress, but that are truly forced, may not be morally significant. Do you guys understand what I'm saying? Like, the person performing the act may not be morally responsible or culpable for it. So, you know, for instance, consider a man who is forced to remove cash from a convenience store because he's at gunpoint. He doesn't not intend to steal the money, nor is the faculty of his soul, we call the will, directing him to do so. Since he is being forced to act against his will and without any intention to steal, you know, he's not morally culpable for the act, even though he is the actor removing the cash. So people can, in fact, perform exactly the same action with or without the intention or with different intentions. And these actions, or these intentions, or rather, or lack of them, can potentially change the moral quality of the act itself. So I want to jump into human acts a little bit more in detail in continuity with the sources of the morality of human acts, specifically object, intention, and circumstance. So I think what I specifically want to touch on in regards to human acts is we went over intention. There's some questions that you can ask that I think I wanted to share because I thought that would add a really practical side to this topic, and that is, if we answer the question, like, why am I doing this, we discover our intention. You know, we must have an intention for a particular act to be fully human. So if we lack intention, the act is something less than a fully human act, put simply as I can. We do not and cannot call an act that is forced upon us, like being pulled or pushed in a particular direction, like a fully human act, because the individual that's being pushed or pulled did not engage, like, his reason or will in the process, you know, faculties which are intrinsic to being human and engaging in authentic, fully human acts. Okay, so I want to talk about object for a moment, because in asking these questions, like, what else is required for an action to be fully human? And so here we return to the sources of morality. And an act that is fully human always has an object towards something which it's moving. So if we answer the question, like, what am I doing? We discover the object. For instance, let's return to our example. So like when we said earlier with intention, we said, why am I doing? And now we're saying, what am I doing? So let's return to our example of where we're giving money to the poor. Let's say you ask yourself, why am I doing this? And if your goal is to help the poor, then that is my intention, and its moral quality is good. If I ask, what am I doing? I discover the object, which is to give money to the poor. You know, it's important to note that a particular object can be morally good or evil according to the objective moral norms. So whatever is being objectively chosen is a good toward which the will deliberately directs itself, because it is a matter of a human act. And the object that's chosen morally will specify the act of the will insofar as reason recognizes it and discerns it to be or not to be in conformity with the true good. So essentially, objective norms of morality is an expression of the rational order between good and evil, which is attested to essentially by conscience, because there's a lot of information in the quote from the Catechism. It has a whole paragraph on it, 1751. And it speaks about that some of the chosen objects, some acts, are in themselves objectively evil. And as some, good intentions are particular circumstances. You know, they can't change their moral quality from good to bad. For example, like if a man voluntarily chooses to commit like a moral, very, very moral sin, like adultery, that object of choice is itself intrinsically bad, disordered and evil through and through. Like, although he may intend something apparently good in his choice, the moral quality of the act remains evil. Further, the act of adultery can be, you know, committed interiorly, as we see in scripture, with the deliberate, you know, assent of the intellect and the intention of the will, devoid of like any exterior manifestation of that idea. And we see like Christ's warning of this in Matthew 27. You know, the point is, when a disordered or bad object is chosen, the act is morally disordered, regardless of intentions or circumstances. Does that make sense? Because, like, although good intentions are an important element in evaluating the moral nature of human acts, in themselves, they cannot make a bad human act into a morally good or even neutral one, right? All right, so let's return to our example of giving money to the poor. If a person, like, if you give money to the poor, why don't I just say that to begin with? If you give money to the poor, for this purpose, like the object, giving money to aid the poor is good. However, you know, if the intention the person has in giving money is to gain, like, approbation, I guess, from his friends, the moral quality of the act is bad or evil, because the intention is in itself bad. So, like, good object plus good intention equals morally good act, while a good object plus bad intention equals morally bad act, and a evil object plus a good intention equals morally bad act. So you can only get good when you have a good and a good. You get bad when you have a good with a bad. You get bad when you have a bad with a bad. So your only way to get that morally good act would be the good object plus the good intention. All right. Lastly, I kind of want to talk about circumstances, because human acts, they don't take place in a vacuum cleaner. You know, every act is done within particular circumstances. So, like, the circumstances of the act consider basically all of the conditions surrounding a particular act. So, like, the locations, the pressures from peers, the suggestions from people involved, and just, like, the other activities of people or actors taking part in some way in the action considered. So, often the circumstances shape or even limit the actions available to us. So, however, as long as one elects to perform an action, one freely chooses to perform an action, even if one would prefer circumstances to be different or would prefer other actions to be available to choose from. So the action is a human one, right? Like, the circumstances, including the consequences, are a secondary element of a moral act. You know, they contribute to increasing or diminishing the moral goodness of evil or human acts. You know, for example, the amount of a theft. Like, they can also diminish or increase the agent's responsibility, such as acting out of fear of death. Like, circumstances of themselves cannot change the moral quality of acts. They can make neither good nor right an action that is in itself evil. So, you know, we're noting here how circumstances cannot change essentially the moral quality of an act, but they actually have an influence on its level of moral goodness. Evil has a secondary element of the moral act. Like, returning again to the example of giving money to the poor, you know, if the circumstances are such that friends encourage the money giving, the person giving aid to the garner media attention for his charitable gift, and he refuses, wanting to maintain his purity of intention, then, like, the moral goodness of the act would be increased from him personally. So, like, the moral quality of his act is elevated and the goodness is increased. So this is primarily due to the fact that he or she, is courageously resisting pressure to accept and to act on a less than good or bad intention. So the resistance of advice in favor of bad intent is morally praiseworthy on part of the agent. All right. So, but, like, on the other hand, if our charitable giver, whom we're talking about, is told by friends to avoid seeking media attention, and he chooses to do so anyways, like, his decision embracing wrong intent would not only render the moral quality of the act, but would make it worse than if the circumstances had been such that his friends were uninvolved. Okay, so, because he is, like, advised to intend what is good, to do the right thing, and is voluntarily rejecting the advice and choosing a bad intention, like, he's more adamant and calculated in that wrong choice. So in order to fully evaluate the moral quality of an act, you must take into consideration the object, the intention, and the circumstances. Although circumstances can increase or diminish the goodness of an evil act, they cannot whatsoever reverse it for the moral agent who's making that free choice. With respect to the object and intention, if the object of an act is evil, then the act will remain evil even if there is good intent. So, for example, an abortion. Someone might procure an abortion with the intention of preventing a child from suffering, which is, in a sense, admittedly a good intention. However, abortion is defined as the direct and intentional killing of an innocent pre-born human person, and as such, in and of itself, intrinsically evil. So the intention to prevent suffering does not negate this evil or transform it into a true good. Finally, if the object of a moral act is good, while the intention of the agent can be bad, then the moral quality of the act is bad. And so, basically, in conclusion, for the moral quality of a human act to be good, both the object and the intention together must be congruently good. Because human acts, they involve the capacities of human beings, especially including the distinctly human capacity of reason. An object, that which is actually desired and accomplished by the action in question, and then the circumstances, features of an action, which are secondary to the object and the intention, which they still help determine the morality of that action. So these, like, include things, entities, and facets, such as, like, conditions, locations, and any other actors involved in the action under consideration. So I want to talk a little bit more about human conscience. I feel like this is kind of important with what we're talking about, just because it's that question of how does, like, the human conscience fit into the free choices we make. Like, it's like those like Disney cartoons from, like, I don't know, maybe like the 60s, in which, like, a little red-tailed devil sits on top one shoulder, and an angel is, like, atop the other, arguing back and forth, each trying to convince the person to, like, make a particular moral choice. Like, is it an arbitrary voice of little importance that we can, like, easily dismiss? Is it what a person feels in his heart? Like, the conscience is not any of those things. The conscience is a gift from God that moves us at the right moment to do good and encourages us to avoid evil. Like, it gives us the ability to make judgments about what is right or wrong, good or bad. Returning to the catechism again, it has an absolute wealth of teaching on the conscience, what it is and how to form it properly, all of those entities. And the conscience judges the choice we make. And catechism, paragraph 1777, says, approving those that are good and denouncing those that are evil. It bears witness to the authority of truth in reference to God, the supreme good to which the human person is drawn. So in the depths of our being, and through our conscience, we can actually hear the voice of God. So our conscience is a gift from God that helps us to attain our end of perfect happiness in God, making morally upright choices and avoiding the opposite, if that makes sense. So deep within one's conscience, man discovers a law which he has not laid upon himself, but which he is inclined to obey. So our conscience is our ability to judge whether a particular act is right or wrong. It's the facility which, I mean, readily tells us what is right. It's that feeling in our gut that you hear people describe that tells us what the right thing to do and or what should not be done in that given situation. So, like, the judgment of our conscience is indeed a rapid one, but it's a reasoned judgment nonetheless. And so our conscience tells us what has been shaped by our experiences, our preferences, and various sources, you know, we view as an authoritative in some way, so that we perceive in a given set of circumstances what is, like, the right thing to do. And I have air quotes around that. So it's actually the conscience that, like, moves us to make truly good acts and to avoid those that are not good or evil through the use of reason. So it enables us to assume responsibility for the acts we perform. And if we intentionally act wrong in any way opposed to the true good, then, like, the judgment of conscience can remain with us, reminding us essentially that we've done wrong. And so it's like this prick of the conscience that you will hear people speak about, you know, like, however, I just want to say that the conscience, like, does more than remind us of the guilt incurred in committing voluntarily bad human acts. The catechism really does a marvelous job of, like, reminding us that it's quote, verdict of the judgment of conscience remains a pledge of hope and mercy, unquote. It calls us, as you can see, the conscience calls us to seek God's forgiveness and to make truly good choices in the future and to cultivate virtue. All right, I want to end on the note of how to educate your conscience, because as we just discussed, your conscience is really, really important, especially in making choices surrounding the object, the intention, and the circumstance. So I want to talk about this, educating the conscience, like, because a person's conscience must be formally, like, properly formed and educated, and that is something that's a lifelong task. Sometimes, like, it is the case, however, that many people are uninterested in forming their conscience, which is kind of why I want to talk about it right now, because I want to raise kind of an awareness for this lack of zeal to form our consciences, or lack of realization that this is a responsibility put upon us by God. So others will actively reject educating our conscience and will dismiss authoritative sources for help, helpful information, helpful assistance, any kind of help. For example, I know people who will intentionally reject the moral teaching of the church through an appeal to personal conscience. Like, they might say, for example, like, I don't follow what the church teaches about euthanasia because my conscience tells me it's a good thing for people who are suffering from terminal illnesses. Like, these kind of statements are a sign of, like, a lax conscience prone to error, which is really concerning to me. So, like, if you study euthanasia, you find that it's an intrinsic evil, always contrary to the good, you know, for a number of reasons, and we don't have time to go into all of them here, but, like, the primary reason why is never morally permissible to engage in direct euthanasia, because it is murder. It's suicide in the case of physician-assisted, you know, cases, and such is very gravely contrary to the dignity of the human person. And so although people must always obey the certain judgment of conscience and not deliberately act against it, it can happen that moral conscience remains in ignorance, and that's concerning. And this is most often what happens when a person's conscience is uninformed or ignorant of particular moral judgment and questions. You know, ignorance of conscience can be imputed to personal responsibility when we intentionally fail to learn, like, what we know we should, and when we have the ability and means to do so, more so. We should never make the mistake of thinking an uneducated, lax conscience can trump the moral teaching of the magisterium. Because erroneous conscience is poorly formed, misinformed, and it just does whatever it believes to be right. And we look at relativism, and we're like, oh, okay, now it makes sense, because people have erroneously formed consciences. You know, we have this kind of, like, invincible ignorance, which basically says that, like, the circumstance in which one acts on an erroneous conscience could not have known better. And then you, like, also have the other spectrum, which is, like, invincible ignorance is, like, when one acts on an erroneous conscience and could have known better. So the person is culpable morally for the act. So it can always be the case that a person's conscience can be blunted or almost blinded through the habit of committing sin and vice, but nevertheless, like, the person remains culpable for the wrong he has done before God. You know, we see in that the ignorance of Christ and his gospel, bad examples to given to others, enslavement to one's passion, assertions of a mistaken notion of autonomy of conscience, like all of these can be at the source of errors of judgment and moral conduct for sure. So recall the importance of a legitimate authority informing our moral consciences and our moral system or behavioral code. Essentially, like, the conscience must also be formed by a legitimately established authority, all right? So along with the word of God, scripture, which includes the two modes of God's divine revelation, which we know to be tradition and scripture, you know, we should also recognize the primary importance of the definitive moral teaching of the church in properly forming our conscience because of its spirit-guided nature, you know, as the, quote, pillar and bulwark of the truth we see in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. You know, furthermore, a properly formed conscience harmonizes perfectly with a morality of happiness approach because it moves us to make choices of a truly and authentically good nature, pointing our lives in the direction of God and moving us to live in a way that is in harmony with God's plan of divine love. So educating our conscience is really essential to this. And it shapes our lives, our human freedom, the virtues revolving around living a life of excellence, which we all want, right, guys? We all want to live a good, virtuous life. But for some reason, it's not something that a lot of us seek. And I think it has a lot to do with what we were just talking about because, you know, our actions shape our lives. So I want to talk a little bit next time we chat about morality. I want to talk a little bit more about, like, freedom and the action and freedom of indifference, freedom for excellence. Those are all different terms that I kind of want to go over a little bit more. I also kind of want to delve into, like, virtue a little bit more and the habits and all of that other the cardinal virtues and just all of these other entities that go into what we're talking about because this is a very in-depth and also just kind of a very beautiful topic to talk about. And there's so much that we could go on and on and on about, such as temperance and developing virtuous habits and revisiting emotions and virtuous temperance and continence and intemperance and all of these other things that will be really fun, I think, to kind of go over. But I want to end with this kind of, like, notion that I just kind of, conclusion, I guess, like, that pursuing a happy life and ultimate happiness means doing truly good things and performing authentically good actions. Like, it is the person who pursues, like, a very virtuous life who is the freest and enters into a life of excellence, essentially, because pursuing virtue, it changes us. You know, it enables us to more easily perform virtuous acts as doing good things become a part of who we are, how we are known to others, and how we are known to God. You know, to embark on the life of virtue is to take an important and decisive step in improving one's character, for sure. And I'm right there with all of you, you know, choosing every day to choose that journey, to take another step in virtue, because I'm a sinner just like the rest of y'all, and I definitely need God's light in my life and his voice in my conscience because the attainment of virtue through its habitual practices, it elevates the human person. It shapes our characters positively and liberates us with the freedom that goes with being associated with virtue. So I hope that y'all have kind of gained a little bit of a fuller understanding of human action and the role of desires and how they all play into virtuous activity, moderate desire, neither too much nor too little, you know, how it accompanies virtuous actions and assists us in the formation of virtue itself. So that's kind of what I want to talk about. So wherefore, though good and bad men suffer alike, like, we must not suppose that there is no difference between the men themselves, right? So I want to talk to you guys about this last little thing from St. Augustine. I want to quote him because it's so good, and it literally covers everything that we've been talking about. So, for even in the likeness of suffering, there remains an unlikeness in the sufferers. And though exposed to the same anguish, virtue and vice are not the same thing. For as the same fires cause gold to glow brightly and chaff to smoke, and under the same flail, the straw is beaten small, while the grain is cleansed, and as the leaves are not mixed with oil, though squeezed out by the vat, by the same pressure. So the same violence of affliction proves, purges, clarifies the good, but also ruins, exterminates the wicked. And thus it is that, in the same affliction, the wicked detest God and blaspheme, while the good pray and praise. So material a difference doesn't make, not what ills are suffered, but what kind of man suffers them. For stirred up with the same movement, mud exhales a horrible stench, and ointment emits a fragrant odor. Y'all, total truth bomb. Thank you, St. Augustine. Just what a saint, y'all. He couldn't have clearly closed this podcast with any better words. So I hope y'all enjoyed today's podcast. I had such a fun time talking with y'all about this kind of cool topic. I'm a fan of stuff like this, morality and all that kind of stuff. I'm also glad that y'all like wanted this, that I had people reach out to me asking for this specific topic. That was kind of like cool, like, oh, my people want this. God's people want this. So thank y'all so much for listening with me. I hope that you will join me next time, but until then, I'll be praying for you. God bless. Also, don't forget to do all those awesome things that all of you awesome people do. Don't forget to leave reviews. Don't forget to like and subscribe, to leave us messages, send us emails at mothermary15@icloud.com. We will listen to your prayer request, and we will get back to you as soon as possible. And we look forward to traveling the road to eternity with all of you. But until then, God bless.